Mark says, you're going to do this democratically, you're going to try to do this peacefully, but ideological interest, class warfare, will lead the capitalist to then resort, when they can't keep their way through the democratic process, they will resort to violent oppression against the workers. Please remember that. Because we usually have it put on Marx that he was fomenting violent revolution against the capitalist. He didn't. He said, but I do fully expect the capitalist to violently react to you. And then he held to the right of an armed, violent resistance. He openly upheld the right of a armed, violent resistance to the violence of the capitalist when they don't like the way the democratic process is going. You need to add to this that neither Marx or Engels precluded a violent revolution eventually coming if the revolution could not be accomplished democratically. And now we're back to where you usually are in your prejudices against Marx. Marx said if the peaceful revolution doesn't bring it about, then eventually you've got to resort to violence. So where does violence come in, according to Marx? Not at the outset. He's not just calling for a coup against the government. But he says either the capitalist will violently try to repress the workers, in which case they have the right to defend themselves. By the way, you'd probably all agree with that, I would think, in general. Or, he said, after you've exhausted the peaceful means of equalizing the material benefits of this world, if they will not, if they entrench themselves, then and only then would violent revolution be called for. And at some places in his writings, I'm trying to remember now, Marx proposes that this could take, 50 years or so. So he wasn't saying, look, they're going to give it to us in 6 months or we're going to take it from them. He said, use democracy. In fact, he said most workers today are too uneducated to know how to use democracy. It's going to take a generation or so, two or so generations. But then, he said, then, if it can't be accomplished democratically, the revolution could turn violent. He also held that post-revolutionary terrorism would be not only legitimate, but recommended. If it does come to violence, if the capitalist war against you and you have to fight back, or after this long period of democratic attempts, if you have to take up arms, he said, after the revolution, terror is not just something that is unavoidable and you have to accept it, but also recommended. He said terror against hated individuals and hated places of recollection by a frightened people to reassure themselves would be called for. Here are people who have taken over, they're frightened, and so those people, like the Tsar and others, who represent their oppression previously, then you could exercise terror toward them. Right, to this point, I hope you understand the place of terror, violence, armed resistance in the revolution, given what Marx and Engels themselves had to say. In the first place, they did not want a violent revolution. They expected it to be democratic. In their view, the dictatorship of the proletariat was quite democratic. But in the end, violence could be legitimated and maybe even necessary. I want you to understand the difference between communism and socialism. But that's a very hard thing to do because these words are used in so many different ways. Just to illustrate how they're used differently, early in his career, Friedrich Engels declared socialism to be contrary to communism. But later in his writings, he presented communism as a school of socialism. That's frustrating to anybody who's trying to be analytically precise, right? So how do communism and socialism relate to each other? Well, the words are used in different ways. And indeed, if you look at the writings of Lenin, Lenin said socialism was the first step, communism a later step of development. So, I mean, which is it? One view says they're opposed to each other. One view says one's broader than the other. The other view says one is a step toward the other. So, who knows, right? But we can, I think, by further analysis, get some distinctive understanding of communism in contrast to the earlier use of the word, the broader use of the word socialism. What communism does that socialism earlier did not do is concentrate on the means of production, class struggle, resentment of capital and surplus value, and the workers' revolution. Workers' revolution. Earlier socialism called for a total social, you know, revolution. Everybody wants to share everything. So communism, just to get your conceptual tools more precise, concentrates on the means of production, class struggle, resentment of capital or surplus value, and the workers' revolution. And this will surprise you once again, I think. Karl Marx opposed socialist notions, which are very common in our day, socialist notions of fair distribution of income. Marx opposed the redistributing of the total wealth of society. He opposed the fixing of prices according to labor cost. These are socialist ideas that Marx opposed. He didn't believe in fair distribution of income, redistributing of the total wealth of society, or the fixing of prices according to labor cost. Well, then what does it mean when he says from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs? You need to write that down. That's one of the mottos of communism, right? From each according to his abilities to each according to his needs. Marx said that slogan, he questioned the viability of it early on after the revolution. That is, in any early phase after the revolution, he said, you can't have from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs. He said, that slogan can only become a reality. Listen, only after people themselves change in their moral framework and their attitude toward work. Once people have been freed of the oppression of capitalism and they go through a period where they don't have to be so worried about their needs being met, and the state doesn't have to be there to coerce them and is withering away. As people are now developing their own potential, you know, through culture, works of art, ideals, caring for one another, and not being worried whether they'll have bread and potatoes tomorrow to eat. Once people have a long period where they can be transformed, they can change in their moral framework and their attitude toward work, seeing work as desirable in itself, that is, you are not going to be compelled to go to work in a communist society. You're going to go to work because you want to go to work. Now, of course, that is a wonderful ideal. I count it as one of the, I mean, for all of the things that are hard in my life, I count it as a supreme privilege that, unlike most people that I know, I do exactly what I want to do to make a living. I get to read books and write articles and do debates and teach people, and I love my work. And if I had all the money in the world, I would be doing virtually the very same thing I'm doing this morning, even though I don't need a paycheck. So, I mean, I have a real sympathy for this. Wouldn't that be great if we all worked because we loved the work and not because we were forced to by circumstances? Marx said, after a period following the revolution, people will change in their moral outlook. They'll work because they desire to work, not because they are compelled to. And then it will become true, from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. Right? There is a glimmer of Christian truth in that. Because if I had enough money to take care of my needs and I'm able to do my research and writing and lecturing and debating and the things that I enjoy doing, and I saw that you needed a bit more, you know, in order to get a new car for your family or something, I would freely give you what I have because I don't need it anyway. So, of course, from each according to his ability to each according to his need. Let me ask you, is there not something of that that's supposed to be reflected in the Christian church? Where without any concern for being repaid, I'll say, of course I'll loan you this money to get shoes on your children's feet. If you can't pay me back, don't worry about it. There isn't enough of that in the Christian church, but there should be. We all preach it as an ideal. Well, Marx had the same ideal. By the way, this is what I was trying to communicate to the Philosophers Association in Moscow. I said, Marx just had, if you will, the evil twin version of Christianity. He had an eschatology, he had a view of history, just like we have an eschatology, a view of history. He believed that people should work because they desire it and they should share with one another freely. Christians teach that as well. What you have here are two religions. Marx, however, said that his was not utopian, but was scientific socialism. Not utopian, but scientific. Because he had all this rational analysis of how it would develop and so forth. It wasn't just desiring something that looks real good and it's really beyond our reach. It's something that is necessary in developing in history. So scientific socialism versus utopian. That would be a great exam question. Explain why Marx communism was scientific socialism in his view rather than utopian socialism. Distinguish all of the misperceptions of Marx and so forth. So do you have a pretty good idea of where Marx is going? What's my criticism of him? Well, before I criticize him, the lasting intellectual impact of Marx, I think, is the place of social economics in history. I mean, it's really difficult after Marx for anybody to give an adequate historical account of anything without looking at the social economics. He did stamp that upon Western culture. Secondly, the greatest polemical concept introduced by Marx, I think he was dead wrong in what he was talking about, but this concept has taken hold and is used polemically, and that's that of exploitation. The rationalizing of one's privilege and the exploiting of others. So the place of social economics in history and the dynamic of exploitation. These are the lasting cultural contributions of Karl Marx. But now how would I criticize what Marxism is now that we've tried to give a more fair presentation of it? Well, the first thing I'd say is that it's outright utopian. That's not scientific at all. It's pie in the sky, by and by. You see that real obviously when he talks about how human nature is going to be changed. We're all going to work because we love it and share because we care for one another. Well, I'll get to that in particular, but my general criticism is this is utopian, not scientific socialism. And I have a series of criticisms here, which I'll have to speak quickly so we can get them in before the tape runs out. First of all, and again, I'm following Thomas Sowell in much of this, not altogether, but a good deal of it. As Sowell points out, speaking boldly in the name of the workers without their consent and contrary to the expressed wishes and views of the workers has made Marxism an instrument of elite domination. Ironically, Marxism has not created workers dictating social conditions, but those who speak in the name of the workers, the elite, dominating others. Secondly, the writing of Marx is so convoluted, so full of jargon, so weighed down with witty epigrams that lead you to overstatement and misinterpretation, It's so subject to this, to so many interpretations, that even in his lifetime, Marx said, quote, "I am not a Marxist." Imagine the frustration, you know. Marxist people are interpreting my words in a way where I'm not a Marxist. So you have Leninism, Trotskyism, Maoism, the German Social Democrats. They all claim to be following Marx, and yet they disagree with one another. Thirdly, Marx's simplistic and arbitrary notion of output per unit of labor. That is the notion that you have this idea of output divided by unit of labor, is crucial to the cogency of his notion of surplus value or exploitation. That is, if it's scientific, exploitation needs to be put down to a rational formula, which was output of a factory per unit of labor. But the notion of output per unit of labor is utterly arbitrary. It's overly simple. It's not scientific at all. The very fact that you can make a mathematical formula doesn't mean there's any connection between output and unit of labor. The input that goes toward the output of a factory or a business includes far more than what is contributed by labor. It includes the entrepreneurship, the taking of risk, the investment, the managerial skills, the interpersonal skills, the selling skills, on and on and on. Labor is not the determining factor. I mean, that is such a simplistic mistake in economic analysis, and that is what drives the whole notion of exploitation for him. Here's an empirical refutation. Countries with less labor input, like the United States, relative to other countries, have a vastly higher standard of living. Now, how can that be? The whole concept of exploitation would make that impossible. But it's not. Where there is less labor, there's nevertheless a higher standard of living for everybody. And so where Karl Marx said we will equalize the standard of living by not exploiting labor, it turns out that when you don't have a lot of labor, you can still have a generalized and higher standard of living. And so he's just empirically wrong about how economics works. He doesn't take account of the unseen capital of managerial skills, entrepreneurial innovation, and particularly personal discipline that makes the difference, not labor. And so Marx was not giving scientific analysis at all. A further problem. Socialist managers and central planners will prove not to be as zealous to seek efficiency in a business as the greedy investors and owners. Well, I have a beautiful example of that. When I was in Moscow, we went to a restaurant one day. There was no one in the restaurant. The waitress would not seat us. My Russian guide, you know, called for the manager, got into an argument with the manager. We finally got a seat at the table. So by this time, I'm going, wow, what's going on? I asked him to explain that. And Lukov says, Greg, don't you see what has happened? Over 50 years of communism have created the mentality that we get paid the same thing if we work as if we don't work. So it's better for her to shoo us away and not serve us, and she'll get paid the same thing at the end of the day, and the manager will get the same pay whether we're here or not. Think about it. Socialism doesn't put pressure on people to seek efficiency and service to others. Only the greed of the owner leads him to say, of course I want you to be happy. What can I get you? Let me give it to you at a lower price than my competitor. And thus, inward motives aside, Marxism does not, in empirical, practical terms, drive down production cost. And thus, Marxism doesn't leave more to pay your laborers, nor does it lower prices, and so it doesn't benefit the consuming public at large. capitalism drives production costs down so there's more money to pay the laborers and makes the price of products lower so that society in general can have it. When VCRs first came out, very few people could afford them. Now everybody's got them in their home. Why? Because of capitalism. It's that competition, quote-unquote, the greed that improved the lot of the workers and the general social condition as well. Marx just doesn't understand economics. Without the profit, incentive socialist planners do not, in fact, take on the risk of pioneering innovation. That's why when you go to Moscow, you will find that they can't fix the machinery and the electronic things that they have over there. People will not invest in the risk of upgrading, engaging in innovation. They'll play it safe for the sake of protecting their position. Okay? In a capitalist company, if you're a manager, you don't play it safe. You try to do better, so you'll take some risk. You'll move ahead. Not in a socialist economy. You say, look, I've risen to this position of being manager. I'm not going to take any chances. No, I'm not going to try anything new. I'm not going to innovate. I'm not going to be an entrepreneur. That's just a fact of life. A planned economy does not prevent the disproportionality of output that Marx was so upset about and was supposed to be the alleged fault of the capitalists for the crises that we go through. A planned economy doesn't prevent disproportionality of output. It merely conceals the disproportionality of output. Here's a good example. You want full employment? We can give you full employment. You can have people dig ditches all day and then fill them in the afternoon. Everybody's employed. But what's the problem with that? It doesn't generate any revenue, does it? But after all, you have full employment. So, yeah, socialism can mask disproportionality of output, but it can't solve the problem. Such disproportionality is inescapable. And so we have to ask, as Thomas Sowell does, pushing even harder, where has there ever been empirical evidence of the alleged increasing misery of the proletariat under capitalism? We're still waiting for anybody to do a comparative empirical analysis that capitalist countries have increasing misery for their working class. Remember, it's comparative compared to a socialist economy. Where is there any evidence of that?